20 years ago, the nation was shocked to discover that, as it was put, Johnny couldn't read. The America's students were not learning the basics, not learning what they needed to know to get out in the world and participate fully in the democracy and in the economy. These days, the concerns are still there, and they seem in some ways deeper and in some ways more specific, that the rising generation will not be able to support this nation when it takes charge. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. We're talking today about education. My guest is author and educator Dr. Alan Gladhorn.
Good morning, Susan.
Welcome. Nice to have you with us. I think the first thing I want to do is check that assertion against your thinking. Are our children not prepared to lead us into the 21st century?
I think they are. I think to a great extent, the society gets the schools it deserves. And the schools in this country are achieving the goals that parents in general want.
Do you know what those goals are?
Yeah, there's been a pretty clear consensus, Susan, over the years, despite the allegations of some who would narrow the school's mandate. Parents want schools to do the following things: develop in the students a good sense of basic values, help the students achieve in the basic academic subjects, develop an interest in the arts, prepare for job and vocation, and be good citizens. Those in general encompass most of the goals of schooling, and there is a broad-based consensus. People agree, except for those who say academics only count.
Those are pretty straightforward, clean-cut goals. Why is it that the nation doesn't believe that it's achieving them?
Well, there are several reasons. First, we're beset by these international comparisons mm-hmm. that, to some extent, are misleading. For example, a recent study indicates that one of the main reasons that our students don't show up well on these international tests is there's not a good fit between the content of the test and the curriculum in this country. But in Japan, there's a much better fit between that international test and the Japanese curriculum. So that's one factor about the public malaise. Second, the American public have always expected the schools to play an active role in the social agenda of the society. And they foolishly hold the schools responsible for some social problems. For example, if there are racial tensions in the school, parents and other citizens blame the schools for that when it's simply a reflection of a broader societal and community problem.
It seems also that teachers get, in this day and age, are coming in for a lot of criticism.
Sure.
They only work 9 months, they only work 5 or 6 hours
yeah.
a day, they have these great salaries, and they don't care about the kids. That's at least what seems to be in the air.
Well, you've summarized the teacher bashing that's going on.
Yeah. And why?
I think to a great extent it's misdirected. Attacking the teacher is an easy way to explain problems, and people want easy solutions. My experience and my reading of the research indicates that incompetence is uniformly found among all the professions. Mm-hmm. Doctors, dentists, lawyers, TV producers, and teachers. And it does no good to find fault with teachers as a whole. There obviously are incompetent teachers, but my experience is that most are committed, concerned people trying to do a good job.
Is this just our desire for simple answers?
I think that's a large part of it. We're frustrated that the economy's not better. We're frustrated that people are out of work. We're frustrated that students seem not well prepared. And out of that frustration is a strong desire to find the culprit. And the teacher is the obvious culprit. My sense is that What's needed, obviously, is strong collaboration between home, school, university, community. That may seem simple, but it's really central to the whole act of improving schools.
We'll talk about that.
Sure.
This is Dr. Alan Gladhorn on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Dr. Alan Gladhorn has been teaching for the last 45 years. He earned his degrees towards teaching from Temple University, a bachelor's in English, then a master's in education with a specialization in secondary education, and then his doctorate in education with his major in curriculum. He's done postdoctoral study at the University of Chicago and at Harvard, also graduate study in his first work, English, through the University of Pennsylvania before and after earning his doctorate. This is Conversations. I want to take a look at possible solutions within
sure.
the problem of education.
Right.
But first, let's see if we can't draw the picture of the problem a little more clearly. We've taken a look at mm-hmm. the way at least part of the population that wants simple answers looks at the problem.
Right.
Teachers and school administrations also sometimes turn around and say, but look what you're bringing us to teach. We have to teach kids
right.
without breakfast and kids who
yeah.
haven't been read to and children who don't know their sums and kids who watch television and
sure.
Examine that charge for us.
Well, you made a very valid point. It disturbs me that teachers respond, as you said, by attacking parents, and that's so counterproductive. The only adversary is ignorance. And the answers, I think, are clear. Without trying to oversimplify, it means the following. Let me just review them briefly, then we can talk about them. It means, first of all, strong parent-school cooperation. Not where the schools patronize parents and use them, but really cooperative efforts. It means, second, a very well-articulated rather than a fragmented curriculum where every year the students study something entirely new. It means, third, much better teacher training and teacher in-service development, so we improve the quality of instruction. It means providing programs to increase student motivation. That's a critical element, as we found. And finally, I think it means having schools and social service agencies cooperate with families in providing needed social services. So it's a kind of comprehensive collaborative effort.
Now
that makes sense to you?
It does, but yeah. How big of a change is it from what we're doing now?
Well, it's a major change,
yeah.
because here's the picture of what's happening now. First, parents are not strongly involved in schools and are not supported in trying to provide a good learning environment in the home. Second, the curriculum is often in bits and pieces, like what you study in grade 9 often doesn't build upon grade 8. Third, many teachers are not well prepared and need to improve in terms of the best current research. Fourth, we have unmotivated students, so we're not doing enough to light their fires inside. And finally, in some communities, we have 6 or 7 agencies trying to serve the same family. It just doesn't make any sense. So I think that with concerted effort, we could start to make a difference.
Maybe this question is appropriate here. It's said about education in Japan that it is held in great regard by the entire society.
Yeah.
People know from the time a child is born that they are beginning an educational
sure.
process that does
right.
take a fabric of relationship between the home, the school, and business. How can we get there from here if we don't have that yet? Does that start with an attitude shift, right?
Let me first discuss more generally the Japanese-United States
okay.
comparisons, if I could, because what you're saying does make sense, but we need to provide a context for it. First, I would caution your listeners and viewers not to focus unduly upon those comparisons. We need the very best schools that Alaska can produce, that the United States can produce. And we need not simply copy or imitate what Japanese schools are doing. But second, we can learn from them. And there have been several major recent studies that clarify why Japanese students seem to do better. The first is the factor you suggest, very strong societal-wide support for schools. The second is a more highly structured curriculum. Third is very strong urging pressure almost from Japanese mothers at home in terms of homework and prep and preparation schools or cram schools. Next, Japanese teachers have much more time in the school day to work together, plan together, and help each other grow. And finally, Japanese schools and Chinese schools as well seem to be characterized by more emphasis upon the group, not the individual. Our schools, like the society, tends to put the individual first. So those characteristics I think we can learn from.
And the attitude you think that we need to develop, or perhaps the steps towards that attitude?
Well, we first begin by clarifying what I said before, that in general we are not divided, that parents and teachers want the same things. And the process of doing that tried to decrease the sense of an adversarial relationship. And that applies as well to teachers as it does to parents.
Do parents and teachers need to sit down?
Oh, yes, they need to spend a great deal of time talking together in pairs and in large groups about these issues. And as I said, the schools need to see parents and the community as a vital resource that they can use in improving learning in the classrooms. Parents, senior citizens can all be excellent volunteers in this process.
I heard I listened to a teacher the other day who said, this is what you're saying, is a wonderful idea, but many teachers don't know what to do with a parent when a parent comes into the classroom, or let's say after school to talk. And parents don't necessarily know how to approach a teacher.
Well, you're right, and we need two things. First, if schools are to use parents as volunteers, they need to work with them in clearly defining what the parent can do to help based upon that parent's unique talents and knowledge. And second, train the parents to perform those skills. The research on using classroom teacher aids, for example, is discouraging. Simply placing an aid in a classroom does not increase student learning because they're not well used, they're not trained. So that's a factor. Second, I think you're right. Parents and teachers need explicit training and how to talk together. So the focus is on solving a common problem, not attacking each other, blaming the parent or blaming the teacher. That's a really crucial skill.
A local high school, Lathrop High School, is going into the community. I've heard visiting churches, one by one, two by two, community centers, essentially saying hello. We don't
sure.
really know how to invite you in, so we yeah. came to visit. Is that a good first step?
Absolutely, sure. I've been to Lathrop and I'm impressed with what they're doing, and I'm sure other schools in Fairbanks area are doing just as much, but they're good people there.
This is Conversations. Alan Gladhorn is developing the University of Alaska Fairbanks first professional school within the College of Liberal Arts. It's Professional School of Education. The School of Education will give minor degrees, major degrees, and a Bachelor of Arts.
And graduate degrees.
Graduate mm-hmm. degrees as well.
Right.
It has a strong cross-cultural education program, links with Japan and with Russia.
Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let me see if I can remember. Over 500 students and 35 teachers, am I?
That's pretty close, sure.
Pretty close. Mm-hmm. The new School of Education, Dr. Gladhorn has come from the Carolinas to participate as the acting director of the School of Education. He'll be with us at least through spring. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. What's wrong with top-down decision-making? I've heard you say that if we're going to develop a curriculum, if we're going to develop effective schools, we can't do it from Washington or Juneau or even from the school district offices. Why not?
Well, the classroom is central, obviously. What happens in a given classroom really counts. And to a great extent, the school is a sum of all the individual classrooms. A recent book has examined that issue, and the authors conclude by reviewing the research that there really are no overall effective schools. There are more effective classrooms and less effective classrooms. That does not obviate the need for strong leadership, but it says it has to begin with the teacher and the students.
What does that mean, effective classroom? I know I used the term first, but what are we talking about?
Well, it's good you ask, because the term is so glibly used and often misused. It's a classroom where these elements are present. First, there's a focus on learning, not socializing. Second, time is used effectively and efficiently and is not wasted. Third, the teacher is using a variety of instructional methods strongly supported by research. And fourth, the students are interested and motivated to learn.
Okay.
It's easy to describe.
That's what I was just thinking. That's easy to say. Let's start with the one I think the nation worries about most, student motivation.
Sure.
Our students are good consumers. I think they know about tennis shoes and VCRs and television shows and
they're
music.
They're motivated to watch football or motivated to spend money, as you're saying.
And that is a certain kind of motivation.
Absolutely.
All right. How to motivate students to academics and beyond, a love of learning.
Yeah, well, we know the answers based upon maybe 15 years of good research. And the picture is something like this, Susan. First, we clarify the concept. Motivation is that inner drive to achieve. And I cannot motivate you. That's something internal. All I can do as a teacher is create the conditions under which motivation is more likely to increase. But aside from that general awareness of the internal drive, there are some specific things that parents and teachers can do. The first is to make clear to students that achievement results from both effort and ability. We tend in this nation to minimize the importance of effort, and we're good at sorting out students on the basis of ability. And we keep driving home the importance of ability. If you have the ability, you can succeed.
The picture in a failure.
Right. Yeah. The picture in Asian schools indicates that effort is what's emphasized. And again at home and in school, students get the message, work, try, you can do it, do your homework, work hard at school. So we have to kind of even out that equation between effort and ability. Next, we need to hold high expectations for all students. And that's especially true with poor youngsters from any ethnic group. At times, teachers and parents, teachers especially, see a youngster from a poor family and says to himself or herself, well, we can't expect much. Mm. He or she is of this ethnic group, therefore, and there are no therefores. We have to say to all students, you can succeed, and I believe in your ability to succeed, but you have to work hard. Third is to make learning more significant to the student, to connect what's studied in class with what the student cares about and feels deeply about. That doesn't mean simply playing to transient student interests, but it means using the community as a place to learn, drawing from present student interests and connecting those with the curriculum, teaching history, for example, so that we focus on the so-called discovery of America from a different perspective. What cultures were flourishing here when Europeans arrived on these shores? The next point is to emphasize the inner rewards, not the extrinsic ones. Parents and teachers too often rely upon M&Ms or rewards of some kind that are external to the learning task. Does that make sense to you?
Sure.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking about is that whether it's the errors or the peculiar roads down which we go in this country in terms of our schools are the same errors or peculiar roads we go down in terms of the culture.
Absolutely.
If you're making $60,000 a year, you're more important than I am, if that's a silk jacket and this is a cotton blouse. They're
Absolutely. Externals.
Sure.
And the youngsters are aware of that. They're not stupid. They understand what the culture prizes. Mm-hmm. And they respond accordingly.
I want to ask you about hidden curricula.
Oh, yeah.
I should say, Alan Gladhorn is the author of 12 books, contributor to another 22. There are at least 35 textbooks I've counted that, of which he is either the major author or a primary author. His latest book is called Teachers as Agents of Change. It's just coming out. Among other things, Teachers as Agents of Change talks about various curricula. There are stated curricula, unstated curricula, excluded curricula, learned curricula, taught curricula.
It's going to get complicated, right?
But it's interesting because when you look at all of these titles, you begin to see, oh, for heaven's sakes, the learning process is very complicated between good intentions and what's actually taught.
Sure.
But what you were just talking about, it gives us a perfect time to bring up the hidden curriculum.
Right, that's crucial. I've been working with schools in the lower 48 to help teachers and parents and administrators uncover the hidden curriculum. Here's an example to illustrate what I mean. Here's a high school that rewards only athletic talent and academic talent in a secondary fashion. Now, if you're a student in that school and you're really strong in music, what's the message you get? Well, from the music teacher, you learn about the importance of music, but the hidden curriculum, the values of that school say music really doesn't matter. We don't reward it, we don't recognize it, we don't prize it. So we've been using the term the hidden curriculum to mean essentially the values and practice of the school that affect the student without teachers being really aware of it. Other examples are the way we group students. The evidence suggests that in general, poor youngsters from any ethnic group are put in low ability tracks and given a very impoverished curriculum. Now that's not done intentionally, but it happens as an aspect of this hidden curriculum, which says we have to sort students out on the basis of ability, and then the lower ones only need this very basic rudimentary knowledge. So there are examples of that hidden curriculum, and their studies indicate that it has more power than the written curriculum. For example, in the area of moral development, Kohlberg, the great genius in the field, found that if schools talked about justice in a very unjust school, youngsters saw the paradox and the dishonesty, and nothing happened. But when you change the school to become a just community, and then you talked about justice, then you saw increase in the students' awareness of and respect for justice.
We can carry this out if I'm talking about environmental ideals, conserving, recycling, and the like in a classroom where we use all sorts of plastic, throw things away.
That's a perfect example. The hidden curriculum says waste.
Yeah.
And the written curriculum says conserve.
If I'm talking
about... And the hidden is more powerful.
It's fascinating,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of fascinating.
If I'm talking about equality and yet I'm not treating you well.
Absolutely. The same point.
All right. So if there is a hidden curriculum, I assume the first step is to name it.
Right.
And then to begin to explore how we teach one set of values without paying attention to
them? Yeah, what I suggest, what I do with teachers and principals is this, involving parents. First, to clarify the concept, as you and I have. And then second, to say, let's be explicit about the stated values we want students to acquire. What values do we have? And we talk together to clarify those and indicate what those are. Then we say, now let's take those values and do a little bit of assessment. To what extent does the school's hidden curriculum support those? Mm-hmm. We identify the major discrepancies, and then we change those that need changing.
This is easier said than done.
Oh yeah, it takes a couple of years at least.
I mean,
because we're dealing with core values and the way the school is organized.
And we all also don't always know that we're not treating a Native student the same as a white student, or treating a female student the same as
Absolutely.
A male student.
Yeah.
Or that we're not valuing violins. I mean.
Absolutely. And first is creating a sense of awareness. So we say, does equity matter? And people say, oh, of course. Does that include gender equity? Of course. Does that include equity among all ethnic groups? Of course. Then we say, what are the hallmarks of equity? Well, one hallmark is who gets called on in mm-hmm. class. And the data indicate that in math class, girls do not get called on. And in classes in Fairbanks, Alaska Native students don't get called on. So we say, well, are we really carrying out this sense of equity in the daily classroom practices? So it's that process of awareness, values, elucidation or support, and then examining and assessing and making changes.
And in that change making, is it a sufficient first step just to say, all right, as a teacher in math class, I'm going to call on my students who are Native, my students who are female, more frequently now. I'm going to make a concerted effort.
Now, what's needed is some systematic training. We know, for example, that there are a set of ways by which a teacher clarifies expectations for the class, where students are seated, how students are called upon or not called upon, how the teacher responds to student answers. Like the research indicates that if a more gifted student answers, the teacher will spend more time exploring that
right.
and drawing the student out. If a less able student answers, the teacher is likely to say wrong, or that's crazy, or that's a great answer. There's no staying with that answer. So there's subtle ways by which teachers manifest these expectations, and they need training first to become aware of it and then to practice these skills.
It's just an overall question. Are we at a point of transition in this nation about education?
I think we are, and it's a very important issue to discuss. We're in a state of transition for several reasons. First, there's increasing interest in a kind of standardized curriculum that might be developed in general form by the state. Now, we're not all convinced that that's desirable, but that's a major move. All across the nation, states are taking a more active role in saying what students will learn grade by grade.
And this part of this is because we're worried about what our students are learning.
Oh, absolutely. Right? That's where it comes from, sure.
This is Dr. Alan Gladhorn. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. Please go on.
The second major transition in the way teachers are teaching, there's a new model of learning called the constructivist model. That's too much jargon, but essentially says that learners create meaning. They make their own sense out of what they're learning. They need to play an active role in this meaning-making process.
Give me a concrete example of that. How do I invest meaning in what I
Well, as I'm talking about the hidden curriculum, your mind's working actively and saying to yourself, is this what he means?
Uh-huh.
Here's an example. You simply didn't passively receive what I was saying, but you kind of grappled with it. You made it your own. You found your own example. And that's what real learning is all about. And we have some pretty good knowledge now about how to create that kind of classroom. It's more problem focused. So youngsters are solving problems, drawing upon knowledge, not simply learning inert or inactive knowledge.
What we think of as performance-based knowledge, that's another piece of jargon, but that's what that is, right?
Yeah, pretty much, but that's a third kind of transition, a transition mm-hmm. the kind of testing we do. We're moving away from paper-pencil tests and more towards performance measures. So if I give you a problem in trying to understand what was happening in the place called Alaska in 1492, I then ask you to demonstrate what you've learned. And you may demonstrate that by developing a TV script, doing a role play, producing a booklet, several ways, rather than answering 20 true and false questions. And so we are in a stage of transition, yes.
Is this an exciting time to be Alan Gladhorn,
for example? Oh, I think it is, yeah. I wish I were 40 again. But no, it's a very exciting time. The challenges are great, but we have some answers. Not definitive solutions, but enough knowledge to begin to move and make a difference. And I really feel hopeful about the future.
Let me stop for just a moment and
sure.
let people take a look at you from a couple of angles. As I've mentioned, Alan is the acting director of University of Alaska Fairbanks New School of Education. He is also, although on leave, the associate dean for graduate studies, research and development at East Carolina University, and has been in that position since 1991. He's been a professor of education at East Carolina University since 87. Prior to that, your longest stretch in one place, huh? 1972 to 1987 with the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education.
I was for 26 years a teacher in a suburban Philadelphia school system.
That's
teacher and principal, right. Mm-hmm.
You have probably been at almost every point along the road of teaching.
Just about, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Also established an alternative school at
right.
one point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Dr. Alan Gladhorn with us on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. We'll take a look at some of the books he has produced in a little bit. We have talked in the course of this first half hour on and off about values. And I want to bring us down to a question that has kind of churned our community here in Fairbanks off and on, and that is the question of whose values are we teaching? There is a there is an opinion that liberal values, non-Christian values, I don't know quite how one would characterize them, but I think you probably know what I mean.
Sure.
Being taught in the school are going to damage our students. And so there's a group of people who would like to pull us to a different set of values than
sure.
they see are being presented. How does a school district anywhere, or how does a school or a classroom anywhere accommodate the varying values of its community without frightening
yeah.
some and alienating others?
That may be one of the most difficult questions that educators face. What makes sense, first of all, is to clarify whose values. And the answer for me is the values of this broader society as expressed in the fundamental documents that provide the basis for the society. And those override any parochial values or sectarian values. For example, in some of the communities in North Carolina, if we were to ask parents about the value question, they would place a value on segregation by race, mm. I think, on believing that being white makes you superior. They would place a value on selling tobacco widely and providing funds for tobacco farmers. My response to those communities is those particular local values lie outside what I understand to be the core values of the society. The society is built upon equity and justice. It's predicated upon the notion that people will take care of themselves physically so as not to be a burden to society. So it's not this community's values, it's the broad societal values. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and I also think that school grounds are also battlegrounds for what values shall lead the country.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Are schools kind of passive inside that?
No, because you see, the irony is that teachers essentially are middle class, middle of the road people, like the rest of the population. But the demographic data show very clearly that the teaching force is drawn from the broad middle class. And in general, they represent the value system of that broad middle class with a complete spectrum from arch conservative, reactionary to radical. There's not a sense of a liberal teaching profession trying to indoctrinate students without values. There's a sense instead of this broad middle class group passing on the values of that society.
Is that, when you say that, I think also that there is a charge that there is a liberal press indoctrinating the country, and there is a charge that we
I wish I could find it.
Right.
I'm a bleeding heart liberal.
There's also a charge that we are kind of puppets on the string of a manipulative
same nonsense.
Washington. I'm asking an educator a question about society, but I think it reflects on education. Is this a reflection that the country feels less powerful than
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Than it wants to, whether it is a religious group or
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There have been several studies that indicate that that sense of powerlessness is endemic, built into the way the society is structured now. People feel they don't have the power, and the response is often mindless attacks on the schools, because the school is a local handy target, and the school becomes a scapegoat for the sense of powerlessness. So the person says to himself or herself, I feel really powerless, but I'll get that local school board mm-hmm. and act out that desire for power.
Okay, now here's a question from the other side.
Sure.
If indeed we are feeling powerless as a nation, and I tend to agree with that, then how do we empower students to learn and empower teachers to teach? They're in the same water. They're in the same bathwater.
Yeah, well, it's a tough question, but I need to score its importance. Another bit of jargon that I'd like parents and teachers to learn is the teacher's sense of efficacy. The research says very strongly and clearly that if a teacher believes that he or she has the power to help students learn better, the teacher acts upon that belief and you get the results. On the other hand, if a teacher believes that he or she has no power, it's hopeless, I can't do anything, they're hopeless, the teacher behaves accordingly, and students don't learn. So we need to restore to the teachers that sense of powerfulness, that you can make a difference without finding excuses or blaming parents. Shape up, and you can make a difference. And you start with that sense of belief in your power. The question of student power is much more complex, because in reality, the schools are not democracies. They're not structured on the basis of what the majority of students want to do. They're structured on the basis of professional decision making. And the complicated question is, within that structure of professional control, how can you give students some sense of power? Well, we've made some mistakes in that. We've created a game called Student Council, in which the student council representatives decide on the next prom motto or some fundraising drive.
Right.
Kind of childish games. Mm-hmm. We've made the mistake of playing games with parents under the rubric of PTA or parent-teacher organization, which again often is manipulative, and that's kind of productive. But to get back to students, there are some modest ways to give students a greater sense of power. One is to involve them systematically in shaping the discipline policies, but to do so honestly, to say, here's the ball field in which you can play. The state has certain rules, the board has certain policies. Now within that, let's work together on some specific discipline procedures. Second, the research is clear that giving students some choice within limits about what they study will increase student motivation. For example, a teacher will say, we'll be spending 3 weeks looking at Alaska in 1500. The goals are these. Now, within those goals, what questions do you have? What special interests do you have? And we'll try to use those to shape the curriculum. But it's going to be difficult because these are 12-year-old youngsters. And I found by a lot of suffering and pain in the alternative school that simply giving students power is not the answer. They did crazy, foolish things with that power.
Balance.
Yeah.
I listened to a principal recently who said, we ought to tell kids what we expect them to learn. First of all, we ought to know what we expect kids to learn in a given course or in a given 4 years of school.
Yeah.
And then we ought to tell them what that is. Mm-hmm. We ought to tell them everything so that they don't, they're not shocked and surprised and bowled over by questions on tests that they're not prepared for, but that everything is laid out for them, and then it's the responsibility of the teacher and the student to work together to teach the student.
Well, much of that makes sense. If, for example, you and I were teaching together a course on Alaska history, we could decide with student input what the final performance or demonstration will be. Mm-hmm. And then we say to the students, at the end of this course, you'll have to do this. And then we'll prepare and work towards that final demonstration. So if we could construct the right kind of tests, then teaching to the test would be the best answer. If test now means these performances, demonstrations of learning. The part that I don't fully support is we always need to provide time for what we could call serendipitous learning. Mm. The learning that comes about unpredictably between you and me and the students as we grapple with a problem. The unexpected insight, the intuitive response to a question, we can always plan for. But in general, that makes sense. Clarify the expectations and teach towards them.
Mm-hmm. This is Conversations. You're listening to Alan Gladhorn. I mentioned that his most recent book, published by the National Education Association, is out now, 1992. It's called Teachers as Agents of Change, A New Look at School Improvement. A book also in press, is called Effective Teaching. It'll be published by Scott Forsman, 92 or 93?
93.
In 1993.
It's now HarperCollins, one more amalgamation.
Oh, right. In 1990, he brought out Curriculum Development for the National Association of Secondary School Principals, and also in 1990, a Casebook for Educational Leaders, published by East Carolina University. I want to ask you a couple of questions that I, again, kind of hear in mm-hmm. the tides. What about a longer school year for students? The 9-month school year is based on an agrarian economy. We'd let kids off from school to go help with the harvest.
Well, the simple answer is no. Mm. The details are these. There have been some good studies indicating that that would be much too expensive in terms of the gains achieved. We'd do much better and save some money by making better use of the 180 days we have and providing good summer programs for those that want them.
What about advanced students in high school going to college while they're in high school?
Absolutely. We should accelerate students in both mathematics and science especially. Let them really race ahead and take college courses anytime they're ready to.
important to stay in high school, not to leap forward to college because there are developmental concerns?
It would vary. I'd give students a choice, students and the parents a choice. Some highly gifted youngsters are feeling so isolated and so rejected by their age peers that they might be better off in college.
Okay.
Others need more experience with peers and should stay in high school.
What about a longer school day? Sometimes it's argued that because there are so many single parents with full-time jobs, so many two-parent families with two-parent jobs, with long work days,
sure,
that some people argue that some homes just can't support homework time for kids because of problems at
home.
So let the kids stay at school eight or 9 hours a day.
That makes great sense, and it's not only sensible, it's supported by good sound studies. The research in Japanese schools, for example, indicates that if you count just the academic classroom time in Japan, it's just about similar to academic classroom time in the United States. Their longer school day provides for more physical activity, more hobbies and special interests, more time for teachers to confer. So they may spend from 8 to 5 at the school under the direction and guidance of professionals, but only maybe 2/3 of that is spent in the usual subjects.
So the school becomes, in part, a community center.
Yes.
I go there to play baseball and violin.
Absolutely. I'm not happy with that because it may give the school too much power, but the reality is the one you describe. Both parents are working. The community is not structured to provide for those opportunities, so the school needs to under very specific controls.
This is just a personal question. Tell me about extraordinary teachers. Are teachers taught, or do they come naturally into this world? But the reason I ask is because I have had in my life 2, maybe 3, depending on the criteria I'm using to judge, just astounding teachers who clearly took me to an entirely different universe of understanding.
Absolutely.
I have a sense, this is my bias, is that they're born. These are extraordinary people. Can an institution create an extraordinary teacher?
Probably no. I usually analyze teaching into 3 levels, the craft of teaching, the science of teaching, and the art of teaching. And it may help your viewers to think about the teachers they've known in these terms. The craft is the mastery of the very basic fundamental skills of teaching in general, like how to organize a class and how to structure a lesson, how to call on students, how to explain. The evidence is clear that the craft of any profession is best learned in practice under a skilled mentor through internship, student teaching. University is not a good place for teaching the craft, because it's out of context, it's the university classroom. So that's the first piece, the craft of teaching. And we know we can pretty much teach that craft, its essentials, through good internships supported by university courses that help them reflect about that experience. The second is the science of teaching. Knowing the research and theory about learning, for example. Understanding this new constructivist approach to learning and what that means about teaching mathematics to grade 10 youngsters. And the science is best taught in university classrooms. It's an academic discipline, and you can't acquire it simply by being in classrooms. Now, the art is the tough part. The art involves creativity, intuition, improvisation, dramatization, spontaneity, a sense of conscience, a sense of vision. That's what we mean by the artistry of any profession, including yours. And you can't teach the artistry. You can nurture it, you can provide conditions for it, but you can't teach it. Does that analysis make any sense?
Sure. So the answer is?
We cannot teach the artist. We can provide conditions, get out of his or her way, but not attempt to teach that artistry.
And the last part may be that, like any interaction, there has to be a certain magic between
that's good, yeah.
The teacher and the pupils.
Right. That's what I've sensed, without claiming to be an artist myself. I recall those exciting moments of unplanned, unpredicted exchange and chemistry between the students and me. Something happened that we all felt alive, more excited.
And that clearly carries past the classroom.
Oh, sure.
And through decades.
One writer calls it the sense of flow, an awareness that something exciting is happening inside you. Mm-hmm. You really feel charged. You know you're doing well. You've lost sight of the particulars of that skill. You're not thinking analytically, but holistically. You feel really professionally alive. And that's teaching at its best.
Mm-hmm. This is Alan Gladhorn with us on Conversations. His career focus, actually there has been more than one. Since 1974, he has had a concentrated focus on curriculum development. Also long-term staff development programs since the 70s as well. He has developed, taught, and overseen programs both in curriculum development and in long-term staff development at pretty much all levels, right, for teachers?
Yes.
Yeah, grammar school to graduate school.
Right.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. I want to make a left turn.
Mm-hmm.
I never know why I always turn left, but I seem to.
That's because you're an artist.
That must be it. A little bit to the left of center. The question is, I think, put this way. I've been reading Jonathan Kozol,
mm-hmm.
His books, Savage Inequalities,
yes.
And Death at an Early Age, are very disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
He creates an eloquent indictment of American education, but also simply of his nation, for terrible service to the poor, terrible service to racial minorities. From your position as acting director of a school of education, how do you see that problem? How do you see its solutions?
Well, first of all, I see it as a significant problem. I don't view it with the same alarm that he does, but I respect his views about that. I'm especially concerned, being here in Alaska, to understand better and value more the special nature of Alaska Native cultures. And I'm impressed with what the faculty of the School of Education have done to sensitize their students to the importance of those cultures. The caution, of course, is that it's a delicate balance. I worry about students stereotyping Alaska Natives, even in a positive way. For example, there is some research that says, in general, many Alaska Native people seem to prefer to learn visually rather than verbally.
Hmm.
But we'd have to use that finding with caution. And the question is, how does that youngster in that class learn best? Not to begin by saying he or she is Alaska Native, whatever that means, therefore he or she learns visually. But developing teachers who understand and value those cultures without patronizing or condescending to those people is really crucial. Obviously, the issue of resources is crucial. Good education does not come on the cheap. Now, the research on school funding is complex and can be misinterpreted. It simply says adding more dollars to school budgets won't guarantee better learning. But reducing class size will make life better for teachers and students in that class. So if we can get and allocate resources more effectively than we are doing, that would help. And finally, I think giving those students a really rich curriculum. The mistake we've made in the past has been to say, they're poor youngsters, whatever ethnic group, therefore let's give them the basics only. And they really need a stimulating, challenging curriculum. I sometimes have said to teachers, take what you do with the gifted students and give it to the least able, because they're the ones that need it most of all.
There's been a lot of criticism in Alaska that we bring white teachers in from wherever, right. Kansas, Montana,
right.
and send them out to
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Oh, poor dear. And send them out to Stevens Village to teach.
Right.
And they don't understand Stevens Village.
Absolutely.
And Stevens Village doesn't understand Kansas. And nobody gets any learning done.
Yeah.
How does that change?
Well, in two ways. We're just in the planning stages of an ambitious program to recruit and support and develop Alaska Native teachers. We really have to take that seriously. But second, more than 90% of the teachers in Alaska are non-natives, regardless of origin. And we really need to develop stronger staff development programs to help them become aware of what you were saying, that there's a way of entering a local village that's different from how you enter Greenville, North Carolina. You do so very cautiously. You keep a low profile. You build trust slowly. You don't rush in and say, I'm here, congratulations. I'm here to save you. But that's a really important problem. And we need to do both. The other thing, of course, is educators now use a fancy term called cultural discontinuity, which is more jargon to say that for all youngsters entering kindergarten, the school is an alien culture. Mm. And especially for youngsters from poor families, whatever ethnic group, it's a very alien, strange world. In many cases, they've not been read to. They've not played school-like games at home. Their parents have not taught them the kind of school behaviors they need. That's not to say they're disadvantaged. It's to say that they come to school as if they're entering a very strange world. And the evidence is clear. As a consequence, they have real trouble in first, second grade until they catch up with the rest.
And so in some ways, do teachers have to teach how to
absolutely.
At school?
How to play school. Yeah. How do you answer questions? Because the school classroom is this crazy place where the teacher asks questions, the answers to which he or she knows.
And at home, right. And at home, the child asks questions.
That's right.
And someone...
to find out something.
Sure.
But school plays this crazy game called question, called discussion.
Tell me, what's your opinion on role models? There is a strong opinion that if I am a little white girl taught only by big white men, that I don't have a role model for me. If I am a native student taught only by white men or white
women.
Well,
that's a partial truth. You and I had role models of significant adults and older peers who showed us how to be in the world. And it makes sense, and there's some evidence that if we can see a lot of commonality in terms of gender, ethnicity, social class, it's more likely we'll make that connection. But that doesn't mean that Alaskan Native students need only Alaskan Native teachers. Doesn't mean that to me. It means they need teacher role models of people who are strong inside, are honest, care about them, are committed to them, value them as people, have high expectations for them, show them what you can do against adversity. And if more of those are Alaskan natives, then that obviously makes some sense.
Are you optimistic about the future of American education?
Yeah. Educators by profession are perennial optimists, but I really am. I need to believe that to go on. I need to believe in the power of schools to make a difference, in the power of parents and teachers working together to make schools better, in the power of students to shape their lives and escape the poverty that they find themselves in.
And what about the rising generation? That first question, are we raising a group of kids who are prepared to lead us into
the 21st
so.
Century? I think so. Like any aging senior citizen, I have concerns about that younger generation, but I tend not to pontificate, especially to my own grandchildren.
Learn a lot. I don't take care of me.
They probably watch too much television. Mm. The evidence indicates that they may be watching something like 30 hours a week. But they reflect the values of the society at large. And you and I made it in good shape. We provide leadership we could, and the coming generation will as well. The hope is they do so with a greater sense of responsibility and not so much as self-centeredness and egoism.
Is that the one thing we have to learn as a nation of?
Oh, I think so, and all the pundits are saying it, so I can say it as well.
Alan Gladhorn, I want to thank you for a very interesting hour. We've been talking with the acting director of UAF's first professional school of education under the College of Liberal Arts, Dr. Alan Gladhorn. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Thank you, sir. Great. Very interesting hour.